Road Song is the story of a terrible accident that nearly killed a 7-year-old child and altered her life in ways others might not be able to endure. It is also a memoir of choices and of courage, of faith and humor, a rather extraordinary family, and of coming to terms. I'm Susan McGinnis, and for KUAC FM in Fairbanks, this is Conversations. My guest today is Natalie Cush. When she was 7, Natalie was attacked by a chained sled dog near the family home in North Pole. The injuries to her head and face were severe, and she was not expected to live. The story she tells in Road Song chronicles the life that emerged from that day forward. Ms. Cush is a writer and an assistant professor of writing at Bethel College, St. Paul, Minnesota. Natalie, I want to thank you for joining us for Conversations.
Thanks, to be here.
My first question is about the nature of writing a memoir, and I think in specific, this one. I've talked to other writers of pith and humor stories who say there's nothing involved in self-discovery in what I write. What I write is commentary, or fiction writers will say they just move into the neighborhood of their characters and their plot, and there's very little of self-discovery, self-revelation there. But this must have been an intense process of discovering and rediscovering Natalie Cush, mm-hmm. and of your values and perspectives.
Yeah, I guess it was really more a process of discovering what my family was about. That was, in fact, I started this book here when I was a graduate student in this MFA program in Fairbanks. And that was one of the criticisms that I got most often early on, was that there was all this sort of philosophy in here. I had already thought through all these events in my head as I was going. And on the page, everything that my thesis advisors saw was, this is what my family means, or this is what the world means. And there wasn't much of the world there. So I guess the big thing in terms of discovery came early on in the writing of this. And later on, toward the end, I realized that there was, of course, more to discover and more sort of thinking through to do. But that was after having gotten down the events, finally sort of given in to writing down what happened besides what it meant.
It seemed to me, and I may be in error, it's just a reader's perspective, that this book both loosens and reveals itself more and more from about the time that you go to college. Mm-hmm. So we've got a kind of an awakening adult perspective, right. here that the writer's looking back on, that when your mom came to Fairbanks to go to college with you, the time of her physical problems, your father's growing frailty. Is it, if that's accurate in any way from your perspective, do you think it's easier to be in touch with the adult as she's emerging than it was to reach all the way back to a 7, 8, 9-year-old child?
I think exactly the opposite. It was so difficult to write the part that was closest to my real age when I was writing it. The only way I actually got through writing this book at all was to sort of sit down and do this almost sort of self-hypnosis period every day when I'd sit down at the computer and put myself into the mindset of myself at 70 when I had perspective on all these things, when I knew what they meant, when none of this bothered me anymore. Of course, the events that are in this book that I didn't really think the book was about, I didn't think it was about what happened, but more about, I guess, what we know because of what happened. The events in here, which happened closer to my real age as a writer, I'd had far less time to grow out of being afraid of or being still upset about. And it became harder the further I went on in the narrative time to separate myself into the body of the mind of a 70-year-old person. So it kind of surprises me to hear people say this, and I've heard this before, that it does seem to be sort of a freer narrative from that point on, from sort of the adult years on. It surprises me because I had to sort of be more constrictive of my own self in the writing of those. Maybe that's the key to writing looser prose, is to be really difficult on yourself.
Right. Make it harder as a writer. We're talking today on Conversations with Natalie Cush. She was born in Los Angeles, raised in North Pole and in Delta, and attended the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Her B.A., gained in 1985. Her Master's of Fine Arts was taken in creative writing. with a thesis called Vital Signs, which has also made up several other publications, articles that have appeared in other publications, and that MFA was gained in 1988. You're listening to Conversations. What do you think about writing a memoir as opposed to writing in other ways? You've written articles, you've written short stories, and you've written poetry.
It took a long time for me to accept the idea that maybe I was going to be a nonfiction writer, more than a poet or something else. Because for a long time, and I'm not sure that I've still gotten over this yet, but for a long time I really believed that it was sort of cheating to write down things that really happened, that this shouldn't be called creative writing because, you know, there's a lot of reportage that goes into telling what happened. And I guess insofar as I have come out of that frame of mind, it was because of writing this book, which did teach me that there's a whole lot of the truth that has nothing to do with the facts, you know, and the facts are sort of barely significant in themselves. And in fact, in teaching writing, this is the thing that I spend most of my time slapping my students out of, is the idea that just because something happened, it's not worth writing about. No matter how dramatic the thing is that happened, it's not the event itself that makes it writing, or makes it worthy of being read either.
I see the truth in that. Give me an example, if I can push your mind to create one, where the truth outdoes, expands on, leaps from the facts.
Well, even the fact of the Holocaust in World War II, I think, there were terrible events. People died, and those who lived were, you know, horribly, permanently damaged. But the fact that World War II happened, or that there were atrocities committed, is merely a fact, you know, from a real intellectual standpoint. And the reason that so many books have been written about that time and on that subject comes from the fact, I think, that we all know that, sad as it is that these things happened, what the real point of thinking about them now afterwards is what we know because they happened. What we know about what human people can become, either those who end up committing atrocities or being victimized by them. What we know about how you know, the world runs, and how events repeat themselves, and what we know about spiritual matters, or even some books, many books, I suppose, on that period of history deal with what we know about how to run a war, even, is part of the point. But what happened, I still maintain, was horrible and awful, but really isn't the point of writing about anything factual.
And it is how the author injects him or herself,
right,
through that series of facts that makes the story.
I think very much of the difference between what people are calling now creative nonfiction and reportage or journalistic nonfiction, much of the difference stems from the fact that I think all creative writing in any form ends up being about the author. Even books, I think, that we write about people other than ourselves. Norman Mailer's book on Marilyn Monroe, for instance, or Gloria Steinem's book on Marilyn Monroe. Both of those pieces are fairly close to journalism, but they're less about Marilyn Monroe in the end than they are about the perceptions of the person who wrote them. You know, I think the consciousness out of which our words come is really what the subject of our words ends up being.
Once again, we're talking with Natalie Cush. She is the author of Road Song, a book that came out in 1990. It's going to be published as well by a press in London in 1991 and also in West Germany in 1991, and it should be out in paperback by HarperCollins this coming fall. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. I want to turn to the stories within Road Song. And I think let's begin with a reading. You and I picked out a couple of pieces before we began. The first of these is set in Children's Hospital, when, for the readers who have not read Road Song or who want to be reminded, when Natalie was down for one of the series of surgeries.
This part on Darcy?
Yeah.
I first saw Darcy by a window, looking down into her lap, fingering glass beads the same leafy yellow as her skin. She was wearing blue, and her dress shifted under her chin as she looked up, asking me, was I a boy, and why was my hair so short? Behind us, our mothers started talking, exchanging histories, imagining a future, and Darcy and I listened, both grown accustomed by now to all this talk of ourselves. Darcy was 10, and she was here for her second attempted kidney transplant, this time with her father as donor. The first try had failed through fault, her mother said, of the surgeons, and Washington State's best lawyer would handle the suit if anything went wrong this time. This threat was spoken loudly and often as long as I knew Darcy, and it was many years before I realized that her parents were afraid, and that they displayed their fear and anger, and in those thousand sideways glances at their daughter. As a playmate, Darcy was pleasant, and she and I made ourselves jewelry from glitter and paste and dressed up as movie stars or as rich women in France. We played out the future as children do, as if it were sure to come, and as if, when it did, we would be there. It was a game we all played on the ward, even those sure to die, and it was some time before I knew that to Darcy it was not a game, that she believed it all. We were holding school, and Nick was the teacher, and Darcy was answering that when she grew up she would own a plane and would give us free rides on the weekends. What if, Nick said to her, what if you die before then? Darcy breathed in and out once, hard, and then she said, I'm telling my mother you said that. Then she stood and left the playroom and did not come back that day. Later, her father complained to Nick's father, called him foolish and uncaring, and demanded that such a thing not happen again. After that, Darcy came to play less often, and when she did, her parents looked on, even on days when Janine took us outside to look at the bay. Darcy grew fretful and cried a good deal and took to feeling superior, even saying that my father didn't love me or he wouldn't be in Alaska. When I forgave her, it was too late to say so, because I was gone by then and didn't know how to tell her. Darcy's absence was a loss not just to her, but to us other children as well. Just as we had no chance to comfort her, to offer our hands when she was weak, we could not count on her during our worst times, for she and her family inhabited fear, suffering in that peculiar way which admits no fellowship. I don't remember if I ever knew what became of Darcy, because I came down with chickenpox and was discharged so as not to jeopardize her transplant. I like to think she must have lived, it was so important to her, and as I think this, I hope she did survive, and that one day she grew, as we all did in some way, to be thankful. One of my smallest teachers during this time was a leukemia patient, just 3 years old, who lived down the hall. Because of his treatment, Samuel had very little hair, and what he did have was too blonde to see. There were always, as I remember, deep moons under his eyes, but somehow, even to us other children, he was quite beautiful. His teeth were very tiny in his mouth, and he chuckled rather than laugh out loud. When he cried, he only hummed, drawing air in and out his nose, with his eyes squeezed shut and tears forming in the cracks where there should have been lashes. Most children's ward have a few favorite patients, and Samuel was certainly among ours. Those few afternoons when his parents left the hospital together, they spent 20 minutes on their return visiting every room to find who had taken off with their son. More often than not, he was strapped to a lap in a wheelchair, his IV bottle dangling overhead like an antenna, getting motocross rides from an amputee. Samuel possessed, even for his age, and in spite of the fact that he was so vulnerable, an implicit feeling of security, and it was partly this sense of trust which lent him that dignity I have found in few grown people. His mother, I remember, was usually the one to draw him away from our games when it was time for treatments, and although he knew what was coming, he never ran from it. When he asked his mother, "Do I have to?" it was not a protest but a question, and when she replied that yes, this was necessary, he would accept her hand and leave the playroom on his feet. I have heard debate over whether terminally ill children know they are going to die, and I can't, even after knowing Samuel, answer this question. We all, to some extent, knew what death was, simply because each of us had been friends with someone who was gone, and we realized that at some point many of us were likely to die. This likelihood was enough certainty for us, and made the question of time and date too insignificant to ask. I remember the last day I spent with Samuel, how we all invited him for a picnic on the lawn, though he could not eat much. He had had treatments that morning which made him weak, made his smile very tired, but this was the same vulnerability we had always found disarming, and I can't recall anything about that afternoon which seemed unusual. The rest of us could not know that Samuel would die before we woke up next morning, and certainly some things might have been different if we had. But I tend to think we would still have had the picnic, would still have rubbed dandelion petals into our skin, would still have taught Samuel to play slapjack. And for his part, Samuel would, as he did every day, have bent down to my wrist and traced the moon-shaped scar behind my hand.
Natalie Cush reading from her memoir called Road Song. I've heard it said before that there is a tendency among people who are well to think of people who are chronically not well in some way, acutely not well, or who are dying, as not whole people, as neither alive nor dead, mm-hmm. particular nether zone. Your writing of Darcy and of Samuel and of your friends puts the lie to it. But it brings up something else that you wrote elsewhere in the book about how many people are what you called emotional sightseers. They don't see the real person. They just want to know the gruesome details. Just to reflect for you and for those who would be interested, this is a line from the book. Those who are truly insightful will know this fact, that the greatest injuries are never those of the body. And then you went on to talk about your mother's pain. What are your thoughts about I don't know what I've just brought up.
When I grew up, when I was in high school, we lived in Delta Junction, which is a very, very small town, made sizable only by the fact that it's next to Fort Greely, which is a fairly, relatively large army base. And I had tremendous disrespect growing up those years for the military people who we knew. Our schools were shared, so half the students, at least half the students in the elementary and high schools, were the Army kids, and we shared churches and sort of intermixed quite a lot. And I had tremendous disrespect for these people, even those who were my friends, because they got so upset about such trivial things. And it wasn't merely trivial things like, having something break down in the house because the engineers on post would just come fix it. That was upsetting. But and it was ridiculous to see people freaking out because their dishwasher was on the blitz or someone hadn't shoveled the sidewalk completely in front of the house. But even things like a guy I knew there had the tip of his finger, not the bone, but the skin on the tip of his finger, cut off in some machine that he was working on. And his wife went into this year-long terrible depression, and where she was crying all the time. These sort of things bothered me no end. And it really did no credit to me to have this sort of frame of mind. I was so so disrespectful of these sorts of people that it sort of manifested itself, I think, at that time in a really uncaring form of superiority in my own mind. Even though I think that was not a good place for me to be thinking from, I do understand where it came, and that was this idea that there are real things in the world and there are, trivial things, and the only real thing is someone who dies, I really thought that, and I guess I still do in a way, that's the worst possible thing that can happen. And everything else sort of is gradations of terribleness, and losing the fingerprint on the end of your finger was not real high on the list of of things to suffer about.
And has that stayed with you today? Are you more calm about the daily crises and ready to leap in when there's a major crisis?
I am really calm in a major crisis. My father was just, for instance, in the hospital, and when he first went in, it was a sort of terrible emergency, we thought. He's had a lung problem for a few years, and he was in a real severe amount of pain one weekend, and we weren't sure if it was his heart or this coughing that had started his convulsions. And I had a terrible day before that. This was on a Friday night, and as soon as he called and I realized that I had to arrange for him to get to a hospital, I was in Minnesota, so arranging for him to get to a hospital from Delta was a little bit peculiar, but everything was fine as soon as he called. In my family, we know how to do crisis. Mm-hmm. But the reason I had a terrible day before that was because I think this is true of most of my family. We're completely incapacitated by mundane things. I had, you know, four students come in the office crying because they didn't like their grades, for instance, and silly things like that had happened, and I was utterly dysfunctional by the end of the day. So in some ways, I've become what I disrespected growing up, in a way, just because everyday things are the things that I suppose we never really learned how to roll over.
Mm-hmm. This is Natalie Cush on Conversations. Your mother's name was Verna, and you write of her about her sense of being a mother. She spoke to me about fear, how it grew from inside you outward, how it dried out your eyes. She said that mothers had 1,000 thoughts to get through with in a day, and that most of those were avoiding disasters. Verna's relationship with her mother schooled her to avoid disaster, and I'm interested in your thinking about your grandmother, now that you are a mother, about your grandmother, her relationship with her mother, and mm-hmm. now your vision of motherhood, now that you're the mother of Charity.
Well, I first of all, I think I'm so much more fortunate than my own mother was, in that my mother was alive till I was 19, at least, until my daughter was 2 or 3. And so I did get to learn some of my ideas on parenthood from her. And she never got to learn that from her mother. Her mother was paranoid schizophrenic, which my mom didn't know until she was an adult. She just knew that she was desperately unhappy at home, and that she always felt as inadequate as you can feel when you're a kid, because of the strange mental games that her parent played on her. And in fact, my own mother was really afraid of becoming a parent herself and determined not to. She gave up that determination when she couldn't stand it, I think. She had to have children. But having talked to her about who her own mother was, who I don't remember a whole lot about. We moved to Alaska when I was 6, and then I only saw her twice after that, I think. And so she never had a tremendous effect on me. But having spoken to my mother about her, and then having had my mother speak to me about her own parenting and what she had tried to do and the mistakes she sort of saw herself making at the time and having made before. And having had her just tell me, for instance, how to hold a baby, which was sort of a real psychological thing for her. She believed that the way you hold a baby would determine virtually everything about that child, including you know, which college they went to, I think. That was a real benefit for me. And I didn't quite know how big a benefit until I started trying to write down for this book how parenthood went throughout the generations of our family. And I realized that I haven't made compared to what either of my parents had at their disposal, you know, for information.
When you were a kid, there was a period during your adolescence where you described yourself as a bit of a roughneck. You defended physically your sisters and brother against the bullies and the bigger kids on the schoolyard and went after people who chided or teased you and whooped them, just beat them up. You said at the time you were a bit baffled by the fact that your mother actually quietly seemed to approve of this behavior on your part.
After a while, yeah.
You seem baffled by it then. Are you baffled by it now? Do you have any sense of where your essential non-pacifist mother was when she said, "Go get him, kid, I'll be behind you"?
It's so ridiculous. Yeah, I do. Partly because my mother really was a pacifist. She was a Christian. She did not believe in defending yourself, unless someone was trying to kill you. But she really believed in this turning the other cheek business. But I'm really convinced now that when she finally sort of submitted to my beating up the bullies who were the other kids, this was her way of kind of turning the cheek in a way. It's in a sort of silly way. She didn't have to beat anybody up. by sending somebody else out to do it, it wasn't her fault. And she never, well, she very rarely, anyway, in fact, I think she maybe only twice she ever said, "You need to go take care of this guy or this girl." But so I think she probably convinced herself that it wasn't her fault. This wasn't her problem, but she would just make all the stuff I needed available, like a ride home when I mysteriously missed the bus after school. All the stuff available that would make it possible for me to defend these kids of hers who were small and shy and who were never going to take care of themselves and who were constantly bloodied by the other kids. So I think her idea, in fact, she said this to me once after I was grown, that the idea was that, well, if one of us took care of this business, then everybody didn't have to be, you know, an angry person. So
Natalie, the winged avenger.
So silly now, but
I want to ask you a question about generations. Your father escaped Poland via Russia and then Poland again during World War II with his family, came over to this country, an immigrant. And so in many ways, you are at least half a first-generation mm-hmm. child. Your child's going to be an American child. She can't help but be because mm-hmm. she's being raised by an American woman, mm-hmm. however much she was, the mother was influenced by Polish values. How does that affect you, and how do you think your life has been formed, structured by being the child of an immigrant?
Tremendously so, I think. I live in Minnesota now. This is my third winter there, and I still cannot get it. And it's not just the freeway business or the kind of clothes you have to wear, but I just don't understand people who don't talk. This is a real Scandinavian sort of college that I teach at, and a real Scandinavian sort of society. People who are so much different from my family and all the friends we had, my parents' friends who were all Ukrainian or Russian or a few Poles or Yugoslav or you know, at least Eastern Europeans.
People won't know what that means. What do you mean about the character of the Polish or the Ukrainians?
I really think it has to do with volume. My father bellows when he's angry, and he bellows when he's happy, and he bellows when he wants you to pass the salt. You know, it has a lot to do, I think, with volume, and also with expressiveness, I suppose. The kinds of things that one expresses are very different, I think, for at least Eastern Europeans than they are from people who grew up in Rhode Island. I do know a couple of people who've grown up in the Midwest. I have two friends in Minnesota who've grown up in the Midwest and who don't express much of anything that is vital to their lives. In fact, things that are I talked to my friend Don about this, and he says that he thinks, he hadn't thought about this before, but he thinks that the Midwestern sort of ideal and possibly the American ideal of sort of self-conduct involves not expressing under any circumstances things that are important, unless it's in the dark, you know, where no one can see your face and with someone who you may never see again, so that this will never be brought up to haunt you. And certainly what I know from where I grew up and with whom I grew up was that you only express vital things. And given the fact that we talked all the time in my family, I suppose we found a lot of things very vital, but or else we talked about vital things at great length or something like that. But I think it's a very different thing for me to be exposed to people who are so uncomfortable talking about things that they believe in or feel deeply that they can't.
This quality of your family seems to be one of the major ropes that helps you pull yourself over hurdles. The blunt facts were talked about. The emotions were worked out with, in front of, through the family.
Mm-hmm. I think partially because, and that may be why I'm a writer now, when you put, for us at least, when you put vital ideas into words, it dissipates their power in some ways. By talking about, in fact, this last couple of weeks when my father was in the hospital, by talking about, with him, about what we would do if he died, where the papers were, and having him call me in Minnesota and say, I just remembered, I needed to tell you that when you yelled at me yesterday, this is probably something that if I die tomorrow, you'll be upset about. So I just wanted to tell you, the guilt stuff is not the Polish way. So don't do any of this guilt stuff. And even though now that I'm telling you that I remember that you yelled at me, you'll probably feel guilty anyway because it's stuck in my head. You should also try to put that out of your mind. You know, by talking about this stuff, it goes away. And
laughter carried it through, too. Carries it through. This is present tense, isn't it?
Yeah, still does. Yeah. It still does. I can't imagine, and I do try to imagine, what it must be like to be inside the head of someone who believes that by not talking, things must go away. I wonder if that's true. I wonder if that's a myth or if that's, it really works for some people. I wonder that very much.
Well, I think there are people's families, cultures perhaps even, who feel if you don't bring it up, it won't happen.
Yeah.
So we keep it quiet. We don't mention it. And that, of course, becomes a sign of good taste.
You know, I am viewed as in very bad taste in Minnesota, I think. Thank you for bringing that up.
This is however she sees herself, or the Minnesotans. This is Natalie Cush. You're listening to Conversations, and I'm Susan McInnes. Natalie Cush has won, been awarded with the Pushcart Prize for 1990. For her book, Road Song. She has also garnered the General Electric Younger Writers Award. That also for Road Song?
Younger meaning under 40, yes.
And the Whiting Writers Award, 1989. Is that Whiting or Whiting?
That's Whiting.
That's Whiting. This is Conversations. More about Natalie Cush and her writings as we go along. I want to ask you about your dad. He is, if I am well informed, the subject of a book that you're currently working on.
Mm-hmm.
He's fascinating in his Polishness. You make comments about calls the other day to say, it's not Polish to be guilty, so don't. Among other things, he said that I culled from the book, it is so Polish to do nothing when... No, I'm sorry. It is so Polish to do something when there is nothing to be done. Later,
however ineffectual that thing may be.
Just do it. Do something. He said something in a... wrapping up what was for him a hurtful moment and putting it behind him. He says, pay attention to what remains, and we won't use up energy wishing backwards. He feels to me like a very emotionally practical man, not at all detached from life, but practical.
Yeah, very much so. And I think it was hard for my brother growing up with being the only boy in the family and with this... man as his father, because my brother is a very, very, very emotional person. in exactly the same way, we're discovering now that he's grown, as my father. But my brother has grown up, or did grow up and is growing up, in the generation where everyone is in therapy, you know, and sort of pays close attention to what they feel. And I often think this must be really difficult for him to know this from sort of societal values that he's witnessed, and yet have a father who believes that while you express things to get them over with, you don't dwell on things, and you don't pay too close attention to yourself. You pay attention to everyone else who's around you, and if they're paying attention to you, then they'll take care of you. Or God will, or somebody else. It's not your job to sort of dwell too much. I think that must have been difficult for my brother, and it's not as difficult for the women in the family, I think, because my mother tempered that quite a lot for us, and she was our gender role and our gender role model, and she did more or less pay attention to what she was feeling. If only so that she could describe it to us rationally and thereby sort of tell us that this is what normal people think. And I know that it's a little bit absurd to feel hurt that this baby bunny died in the woods and we ran across it, but I should tell you that this is a trauma for me. So for my father, I think this is something that he's now, even though he's 50-some years old, trying to work himself out of this tendency not to pay attention to himself, you know. If only as an example to us, I think he's trying to work out of that. Hence the calls about, please don't feel guilty. I realize that humans feel guilty about yelling at their fathers when they're on their deathbed, but you shouldn't. I give you permission to absolve yourself of this.
Can you briefly tell us the story of your father's escape from Poland via Russia, via Poland again? It seems to have created who he is.
Yeah, very much so. World War II started when he was 5, and he was in Poland at the time with his mother, father, and sister and two brothers. And that was actually the last day that he was ever a child. It was difficult, I think, for him to be a father. Not to have children, but to be a father when he finally became one, because he didn't know how kids, you know, what to expect from children, having not been one since he was 5. His mother was Russian and his father was a Polish citizen, and for the first months of the war, they were in Poland, running from town to town, trying to stay away from Nazis. They ended up in Russian-occupied parts of Poland, where his mother convinced the rest of the family that if they could talk the Russian authorities into taking the family to Russia, she could go see her family there and be well taken care of. Eventually they did go to Russia, and things were not better. And in fact, Peter, my grandfather, was so distrusted by the Russian people that, being a foreigner, that he felt gravely in fear of his life, and he knew that however hard he worked to ingratiate himself to the old men who had some say around there, as soon as the old men were dead, and they were dying pretty rapidly, he was probably a dead man too. So he tried to talk his wife into leaving Russia, and she wouldn't. In fact, she tried to have him killed so that by the NKVD, which would later become the KGB, so that she could stay there herself safely with her children. Eventually the family split up. He found out about this plan, and Julia and Peter told their kids to pick which parent they were going to stay with for the rest of their lives. And Peter took the boys, who chose to stay with him, back to Poland. They escaped over the lines. And they spent the rest of the war in Germany. Well, Russia first, getting out of Russia, Poland, Germany, various concentration camps and prison camps and labor farms and children's homes. And they escaped one after another from these things And at various times had to split up because the authorities everywhere eventually were looking for a man and three boys, so they had to pretend to be other people or be just two boys or a man and a boy or just a man and three boys. And that was sort of their war experience until my father was 16 and they ended up, most of them, immigrating here.
Has this made it easy or hard, do you think, for your father to trust or be comfortable in his surroundings or feel like there's a future that's easily before him? Where does he lie on those issues?
It's made him hold very less tightly, I think, to things. We moved to Alaska from California because we wanted our place. We wanted our land. We wanted a house that was ours. And that was important in that way. But the various times when, for financial reasons or other reasons, we've been in danger of losing any of those things, he's done sort of the Polish thing by expressing his dissatisfaction with the situation and then just leaving it and saying, well, it's gone. And sort of expressing this attitude, too, I think, that the rest of us have learned that the worst thing that can happen is for somebody to die. And it feels like a death to lose your house or your land, but it's not a death. And as long as the people are, you know, the people you possess in your life are still in your life, you have everything. So it kind of goes both ways, I think. He's very much into the idea of having his own things. Not so much because he wants to own them, but because if you have your own things, they're not nobody else. You're not answerable to anybody else for who is partial owner. And it's also made him hold to those things of his own less tightly, I think, than a lot of other people do. And I think he requires fewer of his own things than other people.
From your book, Road Song, there was a review written, and I'm not sure where it was printed now, Newsweek or something, in which the writer was extremely critical, not of the book, but of your family, your father and mother, for making the choice to bring you from safe and secure Los Angeles to the wilds of Alaska, where indeed they indirectly courted your accident with the dogs, to force the family into poverty, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What's your response to someone who says that of your folks to you?
There were two reviews that said that. My sisters and I talked about this a lot because it was such a ridiculous thing to say from our perspective that the reviewer said that one of the lines in the Newsweek piece was, so these people go to Alaska and they take their children, but no one said they had to stay there. They should have just gone home. And the criticism was, why hadn't I written a book that was bitter about this? You know, realistically bitter was sort of the connotation. And from our perspective, this is so ridiculous because if I left Alaska to create a life in Arizona, because Alaska is the place where I really feel sort of my soul resides, and I found something that I didn't like in Arizona, I would be in the frame of mind that would say, well, let's go home now. This didn't work out. But when we moved from California to here, the normal thing that happens when you arrive in a new place where you unpack your things and cry because you're homesick and then sort of get on with life didn't happen to us. Because when we crossed the border into Alaska, we did this little sort of family ritual of counting down like astronauts. We arrived over the border, and there was this tremendous feeling of relief, like we had arrived in the place we'd been homesick for. And that never left, no matter how hard things got here. And I know lots of people for whom that's the case, that they arrived in the place where, had they but known it, which they'd been pining for years. So there never was a question of going home or going back. We would have been leaving hard places or hard events to go live in a place which was really second or third best in our minds anyway. So it had, I can see where someone who has never experienced that would think that it was silly to remain here, but I think that's an absurd thought, you know, in terms of who we were. It wouldn't have ever entered anybody's minds to go back to California.
Adversity could in no way be avoided or resolved by a geographic move away from the place you wanted to be.
Yeah.
In the book, again, Road Song, you talk about the family enduring disaster. In the case just preceding this quote, the emotional abuse visited on your sister Leslie, and it's sort of on Ian, the boy, by family friends who were taking care of Leslie and Ian. And you say how disastrously modified we could have become, like bonsai trees pruned at the hand of a perverse and lunatic gardener, malformed, as we all indeed were in small ways, by the inexplicable meanness of outsiders. And yet there were people in it also, in your lives, who asked us questions which began our fruitful looking inward. Where lies for you and for your sisters and brother the growth into fruit in your lives? Why weren't you bent by all these things that happened?
I think it's because we talked a lot. The ones of us who talked the most to each other about and tried to talk about what we felt and what had happened in school that day, and to besides talking about it, try to release ourselves of it through words. Those of us who did that the most have turned out to be the wholest people, and those of you know, those of us who did it least have turned out to be the people who are now struggling hardest as adults to be whole people. I really think it had to do with words, taught us by our parents in some ways. That, as I say, if you talk about an event or use words to describe it, it dissipates and goes somewhere else. And it becomes less real in a way, although I think it also becomes more real, but real externally instead of real internally. So I think that we're all a little bit weird. No, we're all a lot weird, but probably not terminally so.
Can I ask you a question about your faith? Mm-hmm. You speak throughout the book about faith in God, faith in each other through the strength of the bond with a God, and also about churches. Whenever there was a difficulty, part of the family ritual was to contact the churches to get help, but also to gain the help of prayers. You never mention what your religious belief is, and yet it just suffuses the book. So my question is where does that faith lie for you now? And how would you describe what your faith is?
It's remained the same in some ways and changed in some ways, I think. It remains the same in that my first response to having my father have to go to the emergency room a couple of weeks ago was to call all the praying people I knew and said, excuse me.
I know you're busy, but...
it's me again. And so what's remained the same is that for me... the most real thing there is God, and the only person who I really trust is God. I'm not real good at relying on other people at all, or about asking for help too much from other people in concrete ways. But also, ironically, I work at Minnesota now at a Christian school, and I realized when I got there something that has been true for a long time, but I hadn't quite noticed it, that I really like God, but I can't stand other people who like God half the time, you know. And, people I know who are actors love acting and hate theater people, you know, in sort of that same way.
Why is that? How is that? I really like God, but I don't like people who like God.
You know, it could be just that I don't like people. That's conceivable, too. But I think... it may be a strictly sociological thing that organized religion in any sort of genre is is a society of some sort. And it's been real difficult for me and for my family, I think, growing up, to be involved in any sort of bureaucracy or closed society like that. I think this has everything to do, too, with my father's own inability to, or, you know, his own lack of head knowledge in terms of what an organized family structure looks like. We're a very peculiar family growing up because he had no idea what one looked like. Neither did my mother, her with her crazy mother and him with no family structure at all. We ended up sort of being all parents and all children, I think. And because the sort of most basic structure society that people possess in their lives, family, was something for us that was, to some extent, very unstructured. It's been real difficult for me to put up with any form of organizational politics. And there's all kinds of politics that go on, you know, in universities, in schools, and in religion. Mm-hmm. And they're in the same way that the people who a lot of us find least tolerable in a university structure are the people who, within that structure, take it so seriously. The structure itself, not education, but the structure. It's the same way for me in religion, that the people who take the structure of religion so seriously are intolerable people, and those of us who take God seriously are just normal people.
This is Natalie Cush. She is currently teaching at Bethel College in St. Paul, Minnesota. She's an assistant professor of writing and has been in that position since 1988. Prior to that, she did teach at the University of Alaska Fairbanks after receiving her MFA here. And during that process, actually, of working on her FMA, taught at UAF in the English department between 1985 and 1988. She is also currently a book reviewer for the Minnesota Women's Press and has been in that position since 1988 as well. Once again, her book is Road Song, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux in New York in 1990. It's due out in paper by HarperCollins in the fall of 91. You've also written a number of articles, essays, and poetry for periodicals and collections. Are you working on articles, essays now? I think this question is more one of asking you, where now from Road Song? Where are you putting your energies?
I have spent a kind of fallow year since Road Song came out in November. I've been sort of overworked by my publisher doing promotional things. Mm. But that's really more an excuse than reality. It's true that I've been overworked, but I spent the year, and I'm still currently spending the year, working on short things. I have a couple of essays in the works and some poems that I can hardly take seriously because I'm still in my mind, I'm still in the sort of momentum of writing a book, the sort of energy you have to plan out 4 years worth of work on one piece. It feels very different to think about a piece of writing that way. It's sort of slower and you can't use quite as much adrenaline on it because you don't have that much. It has to last for longer. And my work on these shorter pieces is really a way of spending time being a writer, but also working up the courage to do another book. It's going to take quite a lot of that, I think.
And is that book the book about your father?
Right, right.
Will that be creative nonfiction?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what it looks like yet, or even what it's about.
But then I won't ask.
It will come. The events, you know, in it are these sort of World War II things of his, but of course that's not what it's about.
Mm-hmm. Road Song has been very well received, and as far as I can tell, the books are selling very well. I have noticed among friends of mine, people who have also had what we might think of as a hard life and survived it, who are immensely fond of this book, whether it's I'm not speaking necessarily of a physical adversity, but emotional adversity. Have you found that to be true, and are you finding that there is a common chord, a cathartic chord for some readers?
Oh, very much so. I get, at the height of the mail period that I got mail from people, not when I was male.
Right. I was thinking your blue period, your mail period.
At the height of the period when I was getting a lot of mail, I would get sometimes as many as 100 letters a week. Almost all of them from people who would have a line or so at the beginning of their letter saying, I read this book and I love this book, and then who had just felt this compulsion to tell me these terrible stories about their own lives. And I usually try to answer them. So this was a very emotionally trying thing, because there are a lot of people who have had way worse lives than I have. And I knew this intellectually, but to hear what those lives entailed was tremendously painful. They always talked about how good it was to, or how important for them it was to read somebody else's words about a life that they sort of equated with their own. And sometimes these people went on for 10 or 12 pages, writing about their own things and exactly what it felt like to hear somebody else write it down in words. So yeah, I think that there is a. I wouldn't have foreseen that either, but I think there is something that happens or sort of resonates within people who have had lives very much unlike this materially, but very much like this emotionally. That they're judging from the sort of mail I get, it's...
Once again, where the truth and the facts may or may not be related.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you think enough is written through memoir of emotional or other adversity in this country? If you receive 100 letters a day over a given period about this book, it seems to me that you're tapping an emotional chord that has not been tapped.
I'm sure there must be enough written. I just can't imagine that there isn't. But maybe people just don't read it. Maybe it's, you know, put out by very responsible small presses. That, in fact, I know of books that are put out by very responsible literary small presses, which just don't have the sort of distribution that Farrar Straus does. But at the same time, too, I think that much of the sort of inspired writing that goes on now that has to do with personal adversity or emotional adversity has to do with more with kind of how-to and self-help, you know, a sort of approach than it does with just telling a story. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, mm-hmm. but
it may well be the catharsis that brings it for other people.
Yeah, and most of the people who write to me have not thought too much about. There are a few who write who say that, you know, they're in some 12-step program or another trying to deal with what's happened to them, so that they were previously aware of their own kind of hang-ups. But the bulk of the people who write to me say that they weren't aware before, and that they read, you know, they read this sort of emotional mm-hmm. account. Mm-hmm. And become aware then, and this has sort of inspired them to get help or to at least pay attention to themselves, I suppose.
Natalie Cush, we'll look for another book from you. I'm Susan McGinnis. You've been listening to Conversations. Thank you for being with us. Thank you, Natalie, very much.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
We'll talk to you next week.